Our last discussion tonight, before we are opening the session for discussion from the floor, is Alban Rabushka, who is Associate Professor at the University of Rochester, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Rochester. He was educated at the University of Hawaii, University of Hong Kong, and Washington University. He has published a number of books, particularly Politics in Plural Societies, Race and Politics in Urban Malaya, The Changing Face of Hong Kong, A Theory of Racial Harmony, The Urban Elderly Poor, and Value for Money. Quite a list for a man of his age. So it's with great pleasure that I invite Mr. Rabushka.
I hope we can agree on one thing, that last is not least. A succession of mediocre men since John F. Kennedy, an undisciplined, indeed anarchic and leaderless Congress of self-interested aggrandizers, and an imperialistic news media have all contributed to the weakness of our contemporary presidency. This weakness persists, despite a seemingly strong desire by many Americans for a strong president. So what does the disappointed conservative do with a weak Republican president? FDR had changed the ground rules of the presidency, centralizing power beyond the limits of previous office holders. For several decades, Republicans fought this powerful institution, but finally Ike allowed Republicans to cast off their aversion to the use of governmental power. Unfortunately, Nixon betrayed the trust of the use of that power, and Ford's budget deficits and foreign policy of appeasement leads our main speaker this evening to call for a strong president, even a Democrat if need be, to both restore the presidency's relationship with Congress and to hold the Russian bear at bay. I must confess I'm not excited by this call and prospect of a strong president, especially if he's a Democrat. Personally, I prefer a weak president, and if I had my druthers, a weak Congress to boot. I've just reread Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, which lists a substantial array of congressional powers. I've compared it with Article 2, Sections 2 and 3, which authorizes the president's power in foreign relations, and ever so mildly, indeed ever so mildly, suggests that he can recommend measures for the consideration of Congress. My reading of this nearly 200-year-old document is that the framers of the Constitution wanted no part at all of a strong executive. A strong Congress, of course, was not a problem, because the power to levy a direct income tax was not available until passage of the 16th Amendment in 1913. Indeed, it seems to me that the Constitution envisaged a relatively small and weak government with limited authority to interfere in the private economic affairs of Americans. But the reality of our government today in Washington is quite different. All talk about weak presidents or strong presidents has to recognize the current colossal size of just the federal government alone, some $400 billion in spending this year and growing without pause, and the now almost countless intrusions in the private economic lives of Americans by the 1,000 or more agencies of government. The size and scope of our government, and especially its spending, has grown dramatically throughout the 20th century, the personality of the president being rather irrelevant to this epidemic of printing, borrowing, and spending. Indeed, the same could be said of the prime ministers of Britain, France, Germany, Italy, and so on. As well, in this new supergovernment society we now inhabit, I increasingly suspect that neither the president nor the Congress govern on domestic matters. On this, the speaker and I agree, that instead policy is made and implemented by armies of GS-12s, GS-13s, 14s, and 15s, who are responsive only to their own career interests. Some call this a fourth branch of government, a branch free from constitutional restraints of interference and armed with an unlimited mandate to serve the public interest. I'd like, with your permission, to entertain my fantasy world for just a minute. I took my family to Colonial Williamsburg this fall, and we watched a charming movie called The Making of a Patriot before McGarrett became famous on Hawaii Five-O. This movie explains that Virginia's colonial politics contributed to a war of revolutionary independence. But I learned something far more important in the course of watching this film. The royal governor, it seems, was not pleased with the day's deliberations in the House of Burgesses. So he sent over his messenger to dissolve the assembly, which promptly, and I should add illegally, reconvened in Raleigh's Tavern. The floor was then yielded from Patrick Henry to Thomas Jefferson and finally to George Washington, who then offered a philosophy of government in this movie rendition, which I've never seen in any civics or history text. He says, "If a man comes to your door with a gun and sticks his hand in your wallet, this is theft, and we all can agree." He goes on to say, "And if the government comes with his tax collector and sticks his hand in your wallet, this is also theft." It is absolutely crucial to report, for those of you who've never seen the film, or for those of you who can't recall the dialogue, that Washington uttered not one word about representation. His cry was not, "No taxation without representation." It was simply, "No taxation." It's funny that the civics and history books overlooked this point. Or did the movie's producer and director have a view of their own they wanted to make upon all of us who went to Williamsburg? But to return to our speaker's main concluding fear, that we must distinguish primary and secondary threats to our freedom, that we need a strong president to stand up simultaneously to Congress and the Soviets, even if he is wrong on occupational safety regulations, and time permitting, we could list 100, maybe 1,000 other additional areas of regulations. I think a reading of history confirms, though, that liberty and freedom are more often lost from within, lost to a growing and more encompassing government than to outside conquest. A strong president, even a Democrat, might stand up to the Russians more effectively than we witness today. But that same Democratic president might, with the connivance of a Democratic Congress, spend and regulate us all to the poorhouse. A weak president in tandem with a paralyzed Congress, on the other hand, affords some hope that what remains of the private sector might outgrow existing public controls. Indeed, I fear that a strong president might just get us into another nasty war in which no conceivable sense of our interest as a nation of individual Americans is at stake. But this dilemma, as I've manufactured it, nonetheless remains. Weak government is healthy for the country and our economy, but perhaps not so conducive to keeping the Russians in their place. Conversely, perhaps the price of keeping the Russians at home entails a big brother in Washington. But why can't we have a government that provides defense, maintains law and order at home, and does little else? Why can't we have a president who will stand up to Moscow but stand aside from our private economic affairs? Why must we accept at the price of national security a loss of individual freedom? This is not an enticing choice. Whatever happened to 19th century government in America and in Britain, which provided a navy and an army and let its citizens go about the business of making money and freedom? Or is this philosophy and practice of government forever gone? Well, if it is, I for one reject our speaker's call for a strong president. I prefer a weak president, indeed a weak government altogether. I prefer to keep what remains of our relative measure of individual economic freedom than to sacrifice it gradually on the altar of national security. Even if the people have a strong desire for a strong man, I'm sorry, I mean a strong president.